Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwinniger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely 5-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about cybersecurity, and each episode we'll focus on a topic or two of interest to the community. And today we're talking about the Red Report from Picus Security.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And next year's report is going to have a segment on the neuroprazine shortage by Eliza Kassan.
Yeah, that's a tough one over in Detroit. Yeah,
I mean, it's part of the big homeless problem over there.
All right, so this report was passed to me by a fellow Blue Team practitioner. So shout out to Dennis. I asked him specifically if this is a public report or not, and he said it was. So we decided to talk about it. This is a chunk of a report. It clocks in at 175 pages of PDFs. I didn't completely read the report. I don't know if you read the whole thing, David.
I did not read the whole thing, but I did look through quite a bit of it.
Yeah.
I think the report actually stops at 135.
Oh, and the rest is footnotes?
And the rest is footnotes and appendixes.
All right. After I scrolled through so many pages, I didn't even pay attention to the page count anymore. It's just going from main topic to main topic. So Picus Labs, summary, quote, Picus Labs analyzed over 500,000 malware samples between January and December 2022 to identify the tactics, techniques, and procedures exhibited. They observed more than 4.3 million attack techniques, and they identified the most prevalent. This specific report is the top 10. This is a narrowly focused report. This is only focused on malware. So it is not a report on all top 10 attacks used by attackers. It is only top 10 tactics used in malware that they saw.
And it's 175 pages. Very focused.
Yeah. Yeah. This is an incredibly technical report. So for their methodology, they analyzed just under 600,000 samples, but out of those, 507,000 were malicious, or 508,000, I should round up. The source of samples included commercial and open source threat intel services, security vendors, researchers, malware sandboxes, malware databases. That would give you a good cross-section of software, of malware, but it would give you a context-free vision of malware. You wouldn't have any idea how the malware was delivered necessarily. You wouldn't have any like context around, you know, who was targeted or anything like that.
Right, the environment.
I think this is going to be super interesting. So on average, they said each piece of malware demonstrated 11 actions and 9 attack techniques. Although later they said 11 TTPs. So I don't know if actions and TTPs are meant to be the same thing here, but the numbers match up. At the end, they do mention the limitations they found. They called out that the malware is a limited slice, which I appreciate that they called that out. And second, they did mention they don't have any information on initial access, which, again, it's that context around it.
Right. So, how did the malware get there?
Yep. They gave it to somebody on a USB drive, on a floppy disk.
Yeah, it's a 5 1/4.
It's a 5. They listed a bunch of key findings in here before we move on to the top 10. Number one is lateral movement is increasingly done by malware. Remember, I just said this report is purely about malware. So this implies to me more automated lateral movement, though I guess that's not necessarily true.
That's kind of contradictory to something that they mentioned later in the report. Mm. We'll get to it.
Yeah. Although more automated lateral movement would sync with what we've seen about shorter lag times between compromise and, you know, actions on objectives. But again, like you said, there's some contradictory stuff in here. Ransomware is still big. They said 23% of the malware samples encrypted for impact. They saw an increasing abuse of remote discovery and access. Two new techniques on this year's report, which I assume means there was a report last year, are remote system discovery and remote services. This is kind of combined with the lateral movement item, but even through malware, the attackers are still living off the land, and that's called out later where they talk about how attackers still really, really like using built-in tools. Identity and credentials are the new perimeter.
Yep. Firewall's dead. Long live the firewall.
This apparently moved up to the number 2 most seen technique, which doesn't surprise me. I think we've seen in several reports that reusing credentials and credential stuffing are incredibly common. We've got two more. The attackers really prefer using legitimate tools over custom developed ones. And the most common technique in here is the command and scripting interpreter. And there's a bunch of other items in here that are basically built-in tools, including operating system credential dumping, system information discovery, remote services, scheduled tasks, remote system discovery, and WMI.
Yeah, maybe you can answer this question because I didn't get a chance to research this, but what built-in tool can you use for a credential dumping?
I actually did read this section because I was interested in it. And some of the ones they mentioned were copying the registry Hive where credentials are stored. There was another one talking about using volume shadow copy to get a copy of the NT, the .dit file that contains the domain information. So it's not a dedicated utility for getting the credentials. It's using kind of a weird way.
Right. And we'll get into a list about the stored credential stuff when we get down to that section as well.
Yeah. Yep. And final main finding, malware continues to evolve rapidly. On average, like I said, malware uses 11 different TTPs. One third of malware leverages more than 20 TTPs and a tenth more than 30.
That is crazy. Yeah. So they're just saying, you know, that this just shows how sophisticated malware is getting and that their attackers are starting to put a lot more resources behind the development of well-designed malware.
Yeah, which is interesting. There's some conflict here as well, because later they were saying that attackers prefer built-in tools to custom-built malware, but I guess technically it's not that much of a contradiction. They just are building more capabilities into the malware to use the built-in tools.
Right. Yeah. It's like they're building a malware framework and then just pulling in the parts of the operating system or the built-in tools to utilize in that framework.
Yeah.
All right. So the top 10 techniques. First one is T1059 command and scripting interpreter.
Surprise.
Yeah, they didn't see that coming. And of course, what this does is this executes arbitrary commands or scripts and binaries on the target system. So they saw this in, this shocker. So they saw this in 31% of the samples for a total of 159,196 as far as sample counts go. And these are things like VBScript, Unix shell, AppleScript, JavaScript, Python and Perl in some sense.
Yeah, they have a ton of interesting command lines to feed detections in here. Yeah, and obviously you should probably be relying on your EDR or your virus antivirus for heavy lifting here. But if you don't have an EDR or if you're doing some RBA type alerting, there are so many possible alerts here. They spend like 10 pages just listing out examples of command line stuff they've seen and then describing what it does. So this is also an excellent place if you don't have much experience with this. Maybe you're new to this or for some reason you haven't seen much of this. I think this is phenomenal. They have examples for all 8 of the scripting languages that David mentioned, which I love this. But if the whole report is at this level of detail, a lot of it is. This is so much data. It could take weeks to go through this report and make sure you have detections for everything in this report. There is so much data in here.
And even so, if you are doing Blue Team right now, you should read this report. Absolutely no doubt.
I agree.
The whole thing. There's a ton of good stuff in here. Because it not only gives you examples, it explains it. So it's not just, hey, look for this thing and you don't really understand the reasoning behind it. It explains all that. So even your junior Blue Teamers could go through this report and get value out of it. It's not just for your senior guys to look through and get a whole bunch of goodies out of it.
Yep, agreed. This is phenomenal. But anyways, the second one is credential dumping, dumping credentials from the operating system and the utilities involved, seen in 25%, 127,000 samples. Currently, this has risen to second place from fifth place. And again, much like we mentioned before, they list out, I don't know if we want to go into all 7 of these, we'd be here if we go into too much detail on these, but it lists out the 7 places that Windows operating system credentials are frequently stored. And it calls out Linux and Mac specific ones as well. But for example, it talks about the SAM database. This is the one I was mentioning before. This is in the registry. You can copy this by copying it out of the registry. LSAS, of course, where you can use Mimikatz. NTDS.DIT, you can use the shadow domain volume shadow copy to copy that, et cetera, et cetera. And they talk about all the various places where credentials may be, and they talk about a method of getting those credentials out. And they frequently provide an example. I can't state unequivocally there's an example for all of these, but...
Yeah, this is really interesting because I was unaware of all of those places.
Yeah, some of them I was pretty familiar with, like the ones for Mimikatz and memory. I had recently seen the NTDS one, but I wasn't like fully dialed in on it. So that was very interesting to see.
Yep. And then the next one is data encrypted for impact. So basically this is ransomware. And they saw this in 23%, 117,000 samples. And that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, not much to talk about there, really. Next one is process injection, which is adding malicious code into a legitimate process to dodge detection. Because most antivirus and EDR technology, they examine the file on disk and when the executable is run. But once it's in memory, they generally leave it alone because they don't want to cause any issues. There are a lot of EDR tools that can detect process injection, but I feel like they don't do a good job of demonstrating how it's specifically bad. They just see that something was injected, like a thread was injected or some process touched another process. But there's not very much in there about how or why that's going on.
You see a lot of false positives with that?
I don't want to mention the tool that I use, but the tool that I use, it's almost impossible to tell if it's a false positive or not because so little data is given. It just says, oh no, there's a process injected. This process touched this process. And sometimes it's more suspicious than others. Like it'll be, you know, command.exe or something or a scripting that did the process injection. You're like, oh, that's probably not good.
Oh, that reminds me of McAfee. McAfee was terrible for that. Mm-hmm. Complaining that, you know, something was touching McAfee.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just, yeah, we see that too with this product as well. But yeah, all AV ones. But no, this is in memory. This is especially interesting. Because if you ever take a forensics class or do any memory forensics, the code has to fully unpack in memory. So it's very vulnerable there. You can export the executable and upload it to VirusTotal or your AB tool can detect it once it's written to disk. But that's tough once it's in memory because you have to get a memory capture to do that. Anyways, that's tough to write custom detections for this. You typically have to really rely on your AV or EDR, but at least this does provide you with some interesting descriptions of 12 different sub-techniques on how process injection can occur. I was only familiar with a couple of these, like process Halloween. This is a place where I need to study up. So they saw this in 22% of samples, about 119,000.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that they mentioned that there's typically only two primary uses for this, and that's privilege escalation and defense evasion.
Yeah, if you can get a process that's already running as admin or as root, then you don't need to get it yourself.
Yeah. And apparently they've also subcategorized into there's two methods that is used. They hard code it where it knows the process it wants to attack already. And then there's dynamic targeting where it figures out the process on the fly, which sounds a lot more complex than the previous
one. Because
you
grab the wrong process, you can crash the system.
So the next one is system information discovery. So that's collecting information about the system or the network that the malware is operating on. And this was seen in 20% of samples, which seems really low.
Right. Doesn't all malware kind of have to figure out what it's running on? I don't know.
Yeah, that's what struck me as odd. And this is one of the items that I think seems to contradict their talk about lateral movement, because this seems like a precursor requirement for lateral movement.
Yeah, maybe this is just because of the way they collected data, since they just grabbed, you know, 500,000 samples off of various places. Like, there's no guarantee that those samples they grabbed are the ones that are most commonly run, right?
I suppose.
Yeah.
All right, the next one is remote services. So this is, of course, using RDP, Secure Shell, SMB, et cetera. And this was seen 18% of the time.
Yeah, which I thought was kind of low at first, and I thought that kind of made sense because there's a lot of ways built into systems to go lateral, but they're still talking about, they're like remote desktop, Secure Shell are built into the system. So they're already talking about the stuff built into the system. So I assume that these aren't actually built into the malware, but some way of accessing them is built into the malware.
And would have to be.
Yeah, because otherwise, because like, I'm just thinking if the malware itself is simply a backdoor and when you log into the malware and run commands, you're just running commands to the command line, would that count? Or that probably wouldn't count because nothing was hard-coded built in to take advantage of this.
Right.
Yeah, so this is probably that automated lateral movement that we were talking about.
Right, which again contradicts the lateral movement thing. This is only benzene 18%. It's not higher.
Yeah, that's fair. Either way, kind of weirdly low. So the only real interesting thing I saw in here that I hadn't seen before was the SSH one. They talked about how attackers adding their public keys to the SSH key repository so they could log in via SSH from externally exposed systems as a method of persistence. That's a pretty good one. I don't know that I would have caught that.
That's a good idea, though. I wonder how hard it would be I guess it depends on the way the key is documented in the repository.
You'd have to maintain an inventory and you'd have to look at it and be like, what changed and which one changed? And especially if they don't name it like my backdoor key 301 or something.
Right, exactly. They just go based on the other, have it blend in with the other keys that are there.
Yeah. That'd be good.
Now, that might be something you could do. Actually, that might be something you could set up. You know, if you have a Splunk forwarder on every machine, this is one of the files you could grab with Splunk, and then you could have that run as an alert, changes in that file.
Yeah, that seems like an important enough file that should definitely be on your list of things that you watch for changes in.
Yeah, I'm just not sure about how, the frequency of those keys being added. I don't know.
But
if you did that just for externally facing systems, if you have an externally facing system that has to be SSH from the outside, then you could restrict it just to those.
Mm-hmm. The next one is Windows Management Instrumentation, which is infrastructure for managing data on Windows operating systems. You can do all kinds of things with WMI. They mentioned you can just run normal command line commands through WMI. So a lot of these, I feel like, kind of step on each other in some ways. Prevalence was 15% and various things you can do, for example, system and information discovery using WMI. So that's two of those here. You can establish persistence, you can do lateral movement, you can delete shadow copies, can assist in credential harvesting and prevent privilege escalation. You can do a lot of stuff, and you can do it all remotely too. You can be on one system and be running WMI commands on other systems. So
yeah, that seems to be directly tied to like half of the ones we've already talked about or more.
Yeah, I agree. Although, you know what? WMI is actually another weak point for me. I haven't seen much malware that uses it, although there's a chicken and egg question there. Is it because I don't know much about it that I haven't seen malware use it much, or is it because it's not all that common? But yeah, this one's interesting. You can get WMI logs off of a system. There's a log for that. I'd be real interested in taking a look at some of these and seeing if you can write detections around any of these.
When you say there's a log for it, are you saying there's a log category that goes into the system event log, or are you saying there's a completely different log file?
No, it's in the you can export it with the rest of the Windows logs. It's one of the subcategories like RDP or Sysmon.
Okay,
if I'm remembering correctly, I'm thinking there's one place where I brought it into Splunk at one point in time.
All right, and the next one is scheduled tasks/jobs. Which, of course, is, executing a specific task at a specific time. So they typically install these to do once the reoccurring or trigger on an action, such as a user logging into a system. This was only seen 12% of the time, which I thought was really low. I thought this was a fairly common method for persistence.
Well, that makes me wonder if it's almost too common, like if it's reached the point now where attackers know that it, everybody's watching for it because they all expect it.
It's passive.
Maybe.
And one of the methods that they said that you could do this with, which is obvious sense, which I hadn't thought about before, is container orchestration, with like Kubernetes, scheduling tasks for the containers, which works similar to cron on Xboxes.
That's another really interesting one that I don't know that I would catch. I need to stop admitting these things. I'm supposed to be an expert, dang it. So next one is virtualization sandbox evasion, anti-virtualization capabilities, or trying to determine if you're running in a sandbox so that you can quit. Prevalence is 10%, which again, surprising. I feel like we see articles all the time about how all malware checks for sandboxes now and how sandboxes no longer work.
Well, what I think is that virtualization is so ubiquitous now that the checks for sandbox too much overlap native IT infrastructure. And if you relied on this, you'd end up quitting or not
it would never run.
Yeah, not executing when you're actually in a legit environment where you could compromise somebody. So
that's fair. Yeah. So they give out a bunch of methods. And I was familiar with like two of these. I was familiar with like looking at how much RAM you have or how many CPUs you have. But apparently they're also looking at MAC addresses to check if they belong to virtualization vendors. CPU temperature settings, screen resolution, looking at process names and config files that are specifically related to virtual machines, uptime, because frequently a sandbox is spun up just to run it. They may use kernel level rootkits. And then they actually, and again, this is part of why I love this report so much, they provide some ways to set up your sandbox so that you can avoid getting detected by these.
Yeah, I was kind of, you know, I was wondering when they mentioned the kernel level rootkit, if that was just kind of ancillary to what the malware does. They would install a root level or a kernel level rootkit just to do what it does naturally. And a side effect is being able to bypass a sandbox, not necessarily that the kernel level rootkit was installed specifically for that purpose.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, last one.
Yeah. Remote system discovery. So we're looking for remote hosts and network after gaining initial access to the victim environment. Only 8%. And this is, again, another one of those items that seems to fly in the face of what they were talking about with the lateral movement. Because unless you do remote system discovery, how are you going to move laterally?
Yeah, and you'd think that'd be real important. Again, like just thinking, like let's say you're a criminal mastermind and you've sent out 5,000 phishing emails and 10% of people click on them and now you got 500 compromised computers. How do you decide which ones to go after? Like my assumption was that a lot of that reconnaissance type stuff was done automatically. I've seen it a ton where it just runs a lot of these commands that are listed here and then feeds that information back to the attacker so they can decide which one to take manual control of and continue to pursue.
Yeah, or they would have a tipping point that says, you know, if you find this many or whatever, then, you know, go to stage two or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I can't
believe how low that is. 8%, that's way lower than I would have ever expected.
So weirdly enough, I actually just had a thought on why this might be. I wonder how many of these, they did not mention how many of these pieces of malware, only 25% of them were ransomware, which indicates obviously that the other 75% must have a different purpose. I wonder how many of them are crypto miners.
Well, even so, wouldn't they want to move laterally to do more mining?
I don't know. I've seen several people install crypto miners and then do nothing with it other than install it.
Because it seems like, you know, at only 8%, what you're talking about is like the era of self-propagating malware is like coming to a close or something.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Which, crypto miner doesn't show up very often in here. So I don't, that'd be a big question I'd have.
Yeah. Because I would think, you know, we talk about trying to do more automation on the security side, you know, on the defensive side. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about attackers doing more automation. You would think that this would be kind of key to increasing their ability to automate. This is an odd statistic.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're trying not to take down the whole internet. Maybe they're being kind with their malware.
Yeah, because that's what they're known for.
So we went through that pretty fast. I was debating how much detail to go into this because this thing goes into so much detail. I was worried that if we went too deep, we'd be here for like 2 hours. But I think we're at 25 minutes. So interesting. I think we might have gone a little bit too light, but that's fine. That's fine. Any last thoughts on this report? Any recommendations other than read it?
Other than read it? No. But there, like we were saying earlier, you can get some great actual things to do today with this report. You know, this is not a report that you're going to say, oh, well, that's neat, but it doesn't apply to me, or I can't do anything like that. You are going to find something in this report that you can write a detection for, or you can do something within this report. I guarantee it.
Yeah. I mean, so here's an example right here, talking about credential dumping credentials. They're specifically talking about /etc password and /etc shadow. So they specifically call out two tools, the unshadow tool and the lasagne tool. They provide a command line for it. They describe what it does. They talk about how it is used. They have to, you know, you have to use the unshadow tool and then do offline cracking with a password cracking tool. They talk about the file that is output with what's in the file. So even if you're not writing content, if you're in the IR space, now you've got two new things to look for. You're like, oh, unshadow, or if I see Lazan, now I know that they were trying to break into the password files. Like this is, like I don't know that if you do vulnerability management, you necessarily need to read this report, but if you're an incident response, or if you are an analyst, or if you are writing content, or if you're doing threat hunting, like this will fuel your activities for the next 6 months.
At least, if not the next 12 until the next report comes out. But of course, we didn't see last year's report. I wonder if, you know, they just copy and paste the sections from the previous year and just move them around in their order.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. They did say that only a couple of them were new this year. And frankly, a lot of this stuff is probably pretty, like, they don't, like, Process Halloween doesn't necessarily change from year to year.
Right. Because it's not like what the examples they put in here and the descriptions they put in here are not going to be relevant next year.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it may be that's what the report looks like, but we'll wait and see what it looks like next year. And maybe we'll be pleasantly surprised, or maybe we'll pass on reading it next year.
Can you imagine if they rewrote the whole thing, all 175 pages each year?
Oh, man. That would be brutal. It almost be like the Verizon breach report, where that's all someone's job is that report.
Yeah, that I don't mind writing. I think writing blog posts and stuff is fun. But yeah, if my whole job was to do that, I would be
unfun.
I agree. All right. Well, that looks like that is all we have to talk about today. So thanks for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec and subscribe and listen on your favorite podcast app.